Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora, hafa a day, hello lingeta wandok, and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and I hope you've had a great weekend. Coming up on the show today, there's a reshuffling of cabinet in the Kingdom of Tonga. How is PNG and Australia progressing since the signing of the Puk Puk Security Treaty? And Fiji's High Court delivers a damning decision on the commission of inquiry into the head of the country's anti-corruption watchdog. More on those stories shortly here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I say korabwa. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Right, we start in Tonga, where Prime Minister Lord Whakawhanua has reshuffled his cabinet, appointing three new ministers over the weekend. Dr. Siale Akauola is the new health minister. Devita Puloka takes over infrastructure, and former finance ministry deputy chief executive Sivoki Lave Mau becomes finance minister, making her one of the youngest ministers in the kingdom's history. Well, joining us from Nuku'alofa is Prime Minister Lord Whakawhanua. Malolau Maria Bema. Hello, tau mai pong pong ini, Lord Whakawhanua. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Aggie, it's great to be here. Very happy to join you on your show this morning.
Absolutely. Look, Prime Minister, I have to ask firstly, what stood out about these three appointments? Why did you choose Dr. Siale Akauola, Devita Puloka, and of course Sivoki Lave Mau for these roles?
They're all very suitable candidates for the role. Obviously, one of them is from within the House, and the two candidates that we landed on for Ministry of Finance and also for Health appointed from outside.
I do have to ask, though, Prime Minister, I understand that by-election is in the next few months, right, in October, but why was it necessary to actually select these ministers now and not sort of necessarily wait for new MPs in October, in regards to inclusive choices in Parliament?
Sorry, our connection is cutting off, but I think I get the gist of what you're saying.
Yes.
So basically, I've been acting on behalf of all the roles that have become vacant since the judicial reviews. And it was very timely for us since the government has proceedings within the House to fill these vacancies. And it didn't seem necessary to wait until the by-elections in October to fill some of these portfolios, especially the ones in finance and infrastructure. They're very essential that we have someone take over as soon as possible.
Mm. And that's the thing. One of the choices you made, Sivoki Lave Mau, now one of the youngest ministers in Tonga, takes on that important finance portfolio, as you say. Why was she your choice?
It's a bit of a change in gear, looking at renewed blood, new ideas, and also empowering the youth, which is something that I've been advocating for many years. She was one of a few young candidates that we had a look at, and I think we landed on our best on the best Minister of Finance.
Thank you for that.
Just happens to be a woman, but very capable one. She has a history of working within the government ministry at finance itself as a deputy CEO, and she's been in charge of drafting the budget, and after speaking to the potential candidates for finance, I think that we have a winner.
Thank you for that, Prime Minister. I want to move on to health. Why did you choose Dr. Siale Akauola? I mean, this is someone from outside Parliament, again, rather than an elected MP with medical experience. Can you maybe share what particular skills or experience Dr. Akauola comes with and why you thought he was the best fit for the job?
Dr. Gao Luo is a former CEO of the Ministry of Health during previous government administrations. He was also appointed from outside minister. So he has both those experiences that he brings to the table. And I think he's very capable of pushing forward a lot of the reforms that we have, especially with the challenges faced in health. There is currently no medical professional elected in the parliament right now. So I think it was quite essential for us to have someone with his experience behind us as we push forward the government's new agenda for improving healthcare across the country.
Mm. Prime Minister, under Tonga's constitution, I understand that ministers are actually appointed by the king on your recommendation. So I'm just wondering, how much discretion does the king have in this whole process?
The king is still our head of state, and as head of government, I make the recommendation as prime minister to his majesty, and there is some wriggle room there for negotiation over portfolios, but strictly speaking, under the constitution, it's by recommendation of the prime minister.
Mm. Could his majesty maybe reject a recommendation, or maybe even ask for someone else to be nominated?
I think there's a lot of nuance at play, and there is space under the constitution for a nuanced approach where we couldn't have an amicable agreement over who eventually gets appointed after a nomination.
Okay, Prime Minister, what I find really interesting, which many others might also find interesting, is what led to the decision to then have to move Siausi Sovaleni from the health portfolio? I mean, is that decision based on performance, or were there maybe broader considerations behind the reshuffle?
They're largely broader reconsiderations. The composition of cabinet wasn't complete after we came into power in December. We only had 11, whereas we were supposed to have a full cabinet of 12. And then when we lost two members of cabinet after the judicial reviews, there were a total of 3 vacancies. So there was ultimately going to be a reshuffle once we fill the vacant posts within government. And I'm happy that now we have a full cabinet.
Hmm. Okay, well, look, while I have you, Prime Minister, I wanted to ask, what was your reaction to the US imposing a $20,000 bond on visa applications?
I think since the trial, it was very disappointing for us to hear this become a permanent fixture, but we are not dissuaded from pursuing a diplomatic solution towards alleviating the restrictions or the bonds posted on Tongan citizens applying for tourist and education visas. However, we were very pleased to hear that Tonga officially has zero tariffs in the United States.
Mm. I ask that question because, you know, it doesn't really seem like the sort of thing, you know, one's allies would do to a friend or a partner, right? Like, from moving forward now, what will you do? Because we know that there are a lot of Tongans who want to travel to to see their family in the US.
You know, ultimately, it's an American decision, and they have every legal right to do so. But this is something that we are not giving up on. We will continue to engage the United States. In fact, this week, we made a joint statement announcement on improving our fuel supply. The United States is investing in expanding our fuel supply from 30 to 60 days, and as well as better transportation, so we can have a medium-range tanker that will lower the cost of energy in the country. And so even though we have limitations on the visas, we're still cooperating with the United States on other important fronts. But watch that space. We're still working on the visa situation. Understandably, it's very close to home because of our large diaspora and our family connectivity with those, in, especially in California and Hawaii, Utah, and throughout the United States. But that's something that we're actively working on remedying.
Mm. All right. I want to come back, of course, to these three new appointees. Again, we've got Dr. Siale Agaoola as Health Minister, Davita Buloka, who takes over infrastructure. And again, we have Sivoki Lavemau, who's become now the Finance Minister. What now? What are the moves next for these three as we progress forward with their roles now?
So we're going to have a swearing-in ceremony in Cabinet, and that will happen later on this afternoon, followed by a press conference. And then when the House resumes tomorrow morning, they'll be sworn into Parliament as well, and that will be the completion of their official swearing-in and induction processes. From there, it's hitting the ground running, and I wish them all the best, as we have a lot to do before the end of the year.
Yeah, you sound very confident in the three appointments that you've made there, Lord Fafanua. And obviously, we wish you well with this new reshuffle. Was there any other message that you wanted to end off before we finish up?
No, I think it's a great opportunity for us to celebrate those who have been appointed from outside, especially a very young and capable woman at the helm of finance. Finance is the engine room of any government, and I wish her all the best and thank her for taking the challenge, as well as our new Minister of Infrastructure and our new Minister of Health. They're both very capable of doing the job. All three of them have the trust, and of course the His Majesty the King was willing to follow through with their appointments. So I hope that the ministries give them all the support that they need, and wish them all the best as they take upon these very important roles.
Marae ma'ukoroa e ki pare mia, Lord Fafanua. I just want to say thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today. Malo.
Thank you. Malo.
And that, of course, is Tonga's Prime Minister, Lord Fafanua, there, here on Pacific Beat. Well, to Australia's Defence Minister, who says he eventually wants to see thousands of Papua New Guineans enlisting in the Australian Defence Force. Richard Miles, who is also Australia's Deputy Prime Minister, was in PNG yesterday, where he met with Prime Minister James Marape and held talks with Defence Minister Elias Kapavore on progressing the Puk Puk Treaty. Signed last year, the Security Pact will allow Papua New Guineans to join the ADF. Mr. Miles says a pilot program will begin next year that will see a PNG signing up to the ADF.
Work has been happening at a pace to see this treaty implemented, so that not just the commitments to each other are there, as important as they are, and they're very important, but also that there is substance which now sits beneath it in terms of that activities and cooperation between our two defence forces. First among that is the project that we're working on to recruit Papua New Guineans into the Australian Defence Force. This is a huge moment in terms of the history of the Australian Defence Force. It's a really big moment in terms of the history of PNG and in terms of our bilateral relationship. We discussed this today, and we are both very committed to ensuring that by this time next year, recruitment is well and truly underway from PNG into the Australian Defence Force. We are looking at an initial pilot program which will start the process of proving the recruitment pathway. It will be smaller numbers to begin with, but in time we see this happening at scale over the next decade, where we are imagining thousands. People, thousands of Papua New Guineans are recruited into the Australian Defence Force. So we're really excited about taking the first substantive steps down this path.
And that there is Richard Miles, Australia's Defence Minister and Deputy Prime Minister, who is optimistic of big things ahead for PNG and Australia's Puk Puk Treaty. Now, Miles will be in Solomon Islands later today, where he will be opening a new border outpost in the Shortland Islands on the border with PNG. Here in the Pacific, disasters are inevitable. Floods, cyclones, tsunamis, fires, earthquakes. Whatever the disaster, if it strikes your home, there is a way you can be prepared. A go bag. A bag of essential items that could save your life in a disaster. You should pack your go bag now so that if there is a disaster, you can pick it up and go. The things you should put in it are water, food, medicine, toiletries, hand sanitizer, and a first aid kit. You should also pack a radio, blankets, protective clothing, garbage bags, a light, small tools like a knife, a can opener, and a whistle to alert emergency services. Oh, and don't forget copies of important documents. Disasters may be inevitable, but the loss of your life or your family are not. Prepare your go bag now and stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia. Nissan Bolivinaka, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Fiji's High Court has delivered a damning critique of a controversial commission of inquiry set up to investigate the appointment of the head of country's anti-corruption watchdog. Now, it was established in 2024 after Barbara Malimali was arrested by her own staff on her first day on the job as head of the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption. Now, after the commission of inquiry made adverse findings against her and several others, including the former Attorney General Graham Leung and the head of the Fiji Law Society. They went to court seeking a judicial review. Justice Dane Duingeregere delivered his findings last Friday and declared the Commission of Inquiry's report in its entirety to be null and void, and he quashed the report's findings and recommendations. He found the Commissioner, Australian Judge Justice David Ashton Lewis, denied Ms. Malimali and others natural justice. His adverse findings were irrational and his conduct gave rise to a reasonable apprehension of bias. Now, to help us make sense of it all, we're joined by someone who's been paying close attention to the whole convoluted saga. John Frankel, Professor in Comparative Politics at Victoria University of Wellington. Kia ora, Professor, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Kia ora, good morning.
Yes, well, look, before we go into the details, I mean, what was your initial reaction to the court's ruling?
Well, I can't say I was surprised. It's been obvious for quite some time that the Commission of Inquiry was an extremely strange arrangement, and the Australian judge that presided over it made comments that were really quite extraordinary, as did his assistant, Janet Mason. So it comes as no surprise that this has been thrown out in its entirety as null and void.
Well, that's the thing. How would you sum up then the court's findings, especially concerning around the commissioner himself, Justice David Ashton Lewis, though?
Well, the report does find that there were irregularities in the appointment of Barbara Malimali as FICAC chair, but finds that the way that the Commission of Inquiry went around its business was deeply prejudicial. It didn't give the option to the those accused to respond. The way it conducted its interviews with these characters in Sydney and in Auckland was very, very peculiar. And also it found clear demonstration of bias in the comments of Ashton Lewis about the being tasked to hunt down the crocodile in the pond, a comment he made not only on Australian radio once, but it seems on numerous occasions during the deliberations. So the whole episode has been really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and then we look at the Prime Minister and even the President, who also copped flak for releasing the COI's report before those adversely named had actually read it. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it had been leaked before it was officially released, but yes, that was peculiar as well. And of course, the Prime Minister sacked the FICAC chair, and only afterwards was the President brought in to officially kind of endorse this. So the Prime Minister's launched this commission of inquiry, which led to the standing down of two of his deputy prime ministers, Manoa Kamikamitha and Biman Prasad. Manoa has now been exonerated and has now been returned to his position, but that hasn't yet happened to Biman Prasad. Also, the Attorney General, Graham Leung, was summarily sacked. The Fiji Law Society President, Wiley Clark, was named and accused in the report. So there's been a lot of damage to very senior figures in public life in Fiji, and hopefully now this can all be unravelled and that these people can be fully exonerated.
Well, one of those senior figures we talk about is actually Prime Minister Sitiveni Rampuka. I mean, I believe he's yet to comment on the court's findings. Do you think this will somehow damage him politically?
Well, he has said he's considering resigning. I think it's unlikely that he does so. I think it's almost certain that there'll be some kind of appeal process. So it's not the end of the story yet.
Okay, well then, what does this whole saga, Professor, say about the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption? And I say that only because, can it survive or should it survive?
Well, it's a peculiar story because FIACAC was set up under the government of Frank Bainimarama, the government that came to power in the wake of the December 2006 coup, and it was obviously used to chase down his political opponents at that point. There were a few cases against people on the government side, but nearly all of the cases were launched against Garasse, former prime minister, Chowdhury, another former prime minister, and all sorts of political opponents. When the government changed in December 2022, the opposition came into power with a commitment to abolish FIACAC. It was recognized that FIACAC really hadn't played a neutral role at all in Fiji society. But that was impossible because it was entrenched in the 2013 constitution that FIACAC existed. They had the alternative of defunding it, of allowing it to continue as a sort of shell of itself without any kind of resources. They didn't do that. Instead, they tried to revise it. And indeed, the appointment of Barbara Mulley-Mulley was exactly an attempt to try and bring in a new political leadership. But one of the things that seems clear is that the institutions have a certain degree of continuity, even when one tries to change what's going on right at the leadership. And that seems to be the case with FIACAC. The Pacific really has been troubled by a very negative experience with anti-corruption commissions, if you think about the Papua New Guinea experience as well.
And that's it. What do we think the rest of the Pacific can learn from this saga?
Well, I think that it's very difficult to establish anti-corruption commissions, that one has to be very careful about it. They're very important. Corruption is a major problem, particularly in Western Melanesia and Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. But setting up these commissions is far from straightforward. And you have to have people with good legal knowledge, good legal skills. And there's a big question about whether they would have prosecutory powers or whether that should be left to the police. These things are tricky questions and have to be handled very carefully.
Yeah, because I believe the Commission of Inquiry itself was the brainchild of Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka, right?
The Commission of Inquiry was, yes, but not FIACAC.
But not FIACAC, yes. But this Commission of Inquiry was that brainchild of Rambuka. I mean, moving forward, what can we actually see from this scenario now?
Well, I think we can see that, strangely, this Commission of Inquiry controversy, plus all the reshuffles, the pay rises to MPs, have really dogged the government during the second part of its four-year parliamentary term. It's difficult to remember that it did a lot of positive things when it first came in back in December 2022. I think one of the things that this shows is that it's high time that there's a fresh election, that Parliament needs some kind of renewal, that we need to see some new people coming through and perhaps a change in the character of the governing coalition.
Definitely something to look into more, and I'm sure we're going to be able to talk more about that, Professor. But look, as always, just want to say thank you very much for coming through and speaking to us this morning.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That is John Frankel, Professor in Comparative Politics at Victoria University of Wellington. Pacific Beat. All right, to PNG's Enga province, two councillors have been arrested as police crack down on tribal violence and warn that political leaders are not above the law. A serving ward councillor from Lyingham has been charged as an accessory after the fact to willful murder. Police say the charge is linked to the killing of two people on the 1st of August. The alleged killer escaped custody and is still on the run. A second councillor in Kombiam was also recently arrested over a separate incident. With the 2027 elections just around the corner, Enga's police commander Stephen Harris says the arrests should serve as a warning to those encouraging tribal violence behind the scenes.
There was a previous killing, and that matter came to the attention of the RPNGC, and our CID in Enga investigated that. Witnesses came forward. I was sent a video in which certain statements were made about the law not being applicable to that person, and we'd alleged that there was some inducement to people or threats to people who were witnesses in a current criminal investigation not to give evidence, otherwise there might be retribution. And so our allegations in relation to the conduct of the counsellor are that his speech and his video was capable of aiding people responsible for that killing to evade justice. The significance of an arrest like that is that counsellors hold a fairly significant leadership position in society, and if their influence is good, then good things happen, and if their influence is bad, then bad things happen. I'd also said that we would not be pursuing as a priority people who were just somehow incidentally engaged in tribal violence or offences like that. We'd come after the people who fund it and who direct it, because that's how these things occur. So the arrest of the councillor marks the execution of that strategy. There's been another councillor arrested yesterday in the Compiam district, arrested him for attempted murder. And that's the direction that the RPNGC in anger is taking. And what we see when leaders are arrested is that everybody else stands up and takes notice, and then the leaders need to make a choice. Do they want more charges, or do they want to actually help us to solve the problem?
So the councillor in Compiam, is that in relation to another investigation entirely?
Separate thing entirely. But in the past, councillors have enjoyed some sort of immunity, either by people covering up for them or the police not going through with it because of the perceived power imbalance. But that everybody's equal in the eyes of the law, and I'm making sure that our officers are aware of that and they fully implement that strategy.
Well, obviously the elections are just next year. Are you hoping this sends a clear message to people that it doesn't matter who you are, if you're involved in any type of tribal violence or behind the scenes, you will be dealt with by the law?
That's precisely the message that is sent by this arrest. It also crystallises what I've said all along, that the rule of law will prevail. Because once we chop out that root cause, these people have money and power and influence, that can then drive the frequency of these events down, and that too saves lives.
There's been an interim court order placed over anyone involved in tribal violence of any kind in Laayagum, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how it's a bit different from what's done previously?
Yeah, so the constitution in PNG is very unique. It allows judges of the National Supreme Court to protect human rights before there's being an actual infringement. So, well, I've now got the habit of when things get sufficiently bad, where it looks quite imminent that human lives will be lost, I advise the National Court in Lubbock of the evidence that we have, and then the court can consider whether there's enough there to inquire into that. That's what happened with Laayagum.
I guess what's the real benefit of having an interim order?
Usually in the criminal law, you have to wait until the events occurred. So you can't arrest somebody if you think they might murder somebody. You have to wait until after, unless you've got, you know, enough evidence of a conspiracy or something like that. But that's quite difficult. So the distinction is criminally that normally the crime has to have occurred, and we have to then try and investigate and punish. In the civil human rights jurisdiction, we just have to have a belief or a suspicion that somebody is about to do something like that. We can then issue instructions that are aimed at preventing it. So it's a real life-saving intervention, and it's worked effectively in Anger Province under the current resident judge there.
And that there is Anger's Provincial Police Commander Stephen Harris speaking with our reporter Natasha Emick. Now, if you have just joined us, you're joining Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Agatha Bowen. And on the show so far, we already spoke about the reshuffling of the cabinet in the Kingdom of Tonga. You would have heard that we spoke to Tonga's Prime Minister, Lord Fafanua. Also, how is PNG and Australia progressing since the signing of the Puk Puk Security Agreement? And we spoke with Professor John Frankel about Fiji's High Court delivering a damning decision on the Commission of Inquiry into the head of the country's anti-corruption watchdog. Still to come, though, we'll be talking about OFC and also the rare appearance of a seal in the tropical waters of Tonga. But right now, it's time for your news wrap. Yes, me taki ma'ata. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time where we head around the region to get the latest on your headlines from our producer, Dana Kurimov, who's in the studio this morning. It's Monday morning.
It is.
How are we doing?
It feels like Monday morning.
Absolutely. Full on, but hey, we're here. Mm-hmm. I do want to get into it. We're talking about OFC, where New Zealand has actually separated itself from the rest of the pack by not joining the OFC and throwing its support behind FIFA's president. Now, this is amid calls for him to resign.
Yeah, so the OFC issued a statement on Friday praising FIFA and its president, Gianni Infantino, after his widely unpopular plan to sell stakes in FIA's events and competition to corporate investors was abandoned at the start of the month. Now, the OFC was the last of the six continental confederations to issue a public statement, and it splits the vote 3-3 on Infantino's retirement. But that's not to say that the vote is split 50-50. For example, the OFC is the smallest of the six confederations with only 11 members. And New Zealand has already crossed sort of party lines in a sense by publicly withdrawing its support for Infantino.
Wow. I suppose with all of this public discussion on his presidency, what does the road ahead for Infantino actually look like then?
Now, I mean, unless an emergency election is called, which could happen, Infantino's leadership will essentially just be decided as normal at the next presidential election at the FIFA Congress in March next year. Mm-hmm. The confederations against Infantino make up 143 of FIFA's 200 and individual members, which should indicate a clear majority. Yeah, yeah. But like we see with New Zealand, countries within this bloc have already broken ranks and publicly indicated their support. So it's still not clear where the dividing line sits.
Well, that's definitely a story we'll probably will be following to get more clarity around. Okay, Dana. The Vanuatu Maritime Safety Authority, now they're making emergency communication devices mandatory for small boats that engage in inter-island and offshore voyages, which we know, of course,
yes,
with the incidences that have recently happened.
Yeah, so this comes after the search for six people who have been lost at sea between Eremungo and Tanna Island was called off last week. Mm. Now, despite the current safety regulations that already exist, once a boat does go missing, particularly a small boat like the banana boat that went missing, it can be incredibly hard to be located by the authorities. So emergency communication devices use satellite tracking and communications to broadcast their location to emergency services, no matter how far out to sea they are.
Oh, wow. All right. Now, I understand the search for the boat missing between Eremungo and Tanna was actually called off, but what do we actually know of the passengers?
Well, it really depends. According to the Daily Post, the authorities say that there still could be hope for the six passengers if the boat hasn't capsized. Other boats have been lost in similar conditions and have been found with survivors after more than 20 days. But the VMSA has said that if the boat did capsize, the chances of survival dwindle.
That's unfortunate to hear. But look, as always, really appreciate you coming through and bringing us the headlines around from the region here on Pacific Beat.
No worries.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tini Rau Arona.
I walked away with a lot of gratitude.
A lot of gratitude. Yep. That was the key word.
And I walked away with thinking he's an inspiration to so many people out there to be able to hear his story and just walk away with it with full of gratitude. My heart goes out to him.
Yeah, big Moss.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whakawelahi and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now to sport. The semi-final lineup in the OFC Champions League is confirmed now, with host club Burewa FC from Fiji and Solomon Islands Central Coast securing the remaining two places. Burewa qualified with a hard-fought 2-1 win over Lai City from PNG in Group B, while in Group A, a 2-0 win over New Caledonia's Tinga Sport got Central Coast over the line. The first semi-final on Wednesday will feature Burewa against title holders Auckland City, before Central Coast take on Galaxy FC in the second. The team from Vanuatu finished top of Group B after a resounding 7-1 win over Tupapa from Cook Islands, a game in which Galaxy's Brazilian striker Medina rewrote the history books by becoming the first player anywhere in the world to score three consecutive Champions League hat-tricks. So, joining us now on the line from Fiji is Overseas Media Operations Manager Matt Brown. I say good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Yeah, welcome back to Pacific Beat, I would have to say. I suspect fans all over the world have been talking about football in Oceania over the weekend because of Medina. He's really put the OFC Champions League on the map, don't you think?
Well, he certainly has lit up this tournament. As you said there, 3 hat-tricks in a row. This guy just can't stop scoring. He's a scoring machine. He's got great service from his Vanuatu teammates at Galaxy FC. Robertson, another Brazilian, who's just about naturalised in terms of I think he's going to get citizenship soon for Vanuatu. He's been in the country a long time. But he is like the playmaker in midfield and has set his compatriot up on multiple occasions for some of these goals. He's a really, really good finisher, and he's scored some spectacular goals. And he will be a handful, without a doubt, for the Central Coast FC defence when they meet in that second semi-final, 7 o'clock local time, Fiji time, on Wednesday night.
I know, and that's it. Looking ahead to the semi-finals, again with Medina on board, would you agree that Galaxy is going to be hard to stop?
Yeah, they will be. They've scored so many goals in this tournament. 14 in their 3 group games. But also have great attacking firepower as well. They've got Rafa Leai, Solomon Islands international, Bobby Leslie, Solomon Islands international up front. They've got their captain, Jarvin Way, who scored a terrific free kick in their final group match to get into the semis yesterday over AS Tiga Sport. And he is another guy who's played really well in this tournament. They've got probably 6, 7, 8 good Solomon Island internationals in their team, so they've got a lot of cohesion. And, they played Auckland City in their first match, the 13 times Oceania champions, and it was 2-1 to Auckland City in the end, but they gave Auckland City a lot of problems to the Central Coast. So this semi-final, it's going to be really hard to pick. I think they're 50-50 games, to be honest. Certainly the semi-final involving the team from Vanuatu and the team from Solomon Islands, there'll be some real colour on show too, I think, with the respective fans who will turn up. And then, of course, the first semi-final, the home club, the Fijian representative, Rewa FC from Nazori, that's just sort of out of Suva. They should bring down a good lot of fans. It's like a 4-hour drive to Bar, but I'm sure there'll be a lot of support for them too. And look, they have played well. They've done well to get to the semi-finals. They've got some good firepower. They've got Fiji internationals, Sitaraki Hughes up front there. They've got Te Vita Wāranivalu, their player coach, who's sort of the kingmaker in midfield. So they will provide a handful, I think, for Auckland City. But the thing about Auckland City is that they always seem to find a way. They were down yesterday. They were 2-0 down. And they were 3-2 down. And in fact, if you're going to go back to like 2013, for the last time Auckland City conceded 3 goals in one match in an OFC Men's Champions League. But they came back and they scored twice late on to win the game 4-3. Wow. And it was, they will be, I think, still, they are the tournament favourites. They have the pedigree. They have the consistency. But they are a little bit vulnerable. I mean, defensively, they've conceded 4 goals in group play, and that's almost unheard of. So, yeah, they'll have a tough task against Rewa. And bearing in mind, we have extra time and penalties if needed too. I could see these games going the distance.
Wow. I mean, Matt, another interesting twist, though, is Bertram Suri, right? Former Solomon Islands international, who'll be coaching Galaxy against Central Coast from his home country. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Bertram Suri, he had a prolific career as a Solomon Islands forward. He scored a lot of goals. He was he's a legend in the Solomon Islands, and now he's coaching the team from Vanuatu, so Galaxy FC, and that will be, I'm sure he'll get an interesting reaction from the Solomon Island fans, but he is a legend there, so I think, win or lose, he's just so well-respected in the Solomon Islands. I think he'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, would you give Rewa a chance in the other semi-final against Auckland City? Bearing in mind, I think you've already mentioned the New Zealanders, they've had to battle hard to win all 3 of the group games.
You definitely got to give them a chance. I mean, Rewa are a good side. They've got, it might be 8 or 9 players who have got Pro League, OFC Pro League experience, so who played in the inaugural season of the OFC Pro League, whether for the Buller FC team or for other teams. So they're kind of battle hardened in the sense they've had a taste of professional football. They know what it takes. So I think Orewa definitely have a chance. They will have the home fans, of course, on their side. They're very motivated to become the very first team from Fiji to win the OFC Men's Champions League. It hasn't happened before. So, you know, they've got a lot to play for on home soil. So they certainly do have a chance. They're playing, I always say for New Zealand sides, you know, it's winter in New Zealand. And Auckland City have come from New Zealand. You know, yeah, they've acclimatised. They've had nearly 2 weeks here now. So, but still, they play at 3 p.m. And 3 p.m., it's much hotter than at 7 p.m. And so the conditions kind of favour the Pacific Island players who are playing in the island in those sort of temperatures, you know, day in, day out. So I think that's another advantage for Rewa, albeit, you know, a very small one because the Auckland City team is a very fit team.
Well, all the best for all our Pacific nations that are competing. But Matt, that is all the time we have. I really do appreciate you jumping on this morning to speak with us about the semi-finals coming up.
Thanks very much.
No worries. That is Overseas Media Operations Manager Matt Brown on the line from Fiji. Now, just a reminder, as Matt said, that the Champions League semi-finals, Auckland City versus Rewa and Galaxy FC against Central Coast, will be played this Wednesday in Bar.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, the rare appearance of a seal in the tropical waters of Tonga has created a buzz on social media. The juvenile seal was spotted by fishermen in the group of islands of Ha'apai. Videos of it were posted online with villagers seeking help to identify what type of animal it was and for advice on what to feed it. John Arnold is a professor of School of Life and Environmental Sciences at Deakin University and suspects it's a Guadalupe fur seal that has wandered way off track from its subpolar home.
It's definitely looked like a fur seal. From what I can tell from the videos, it's hard to discern which species. I'd say it's likely, and from the location of the where the videos were taken, it could be anything from a Galapagos fur seal or a Guadalupe fur seal, even a South American fur seal, or potentially, I don't think it's a New Zealand fur seal. It doesn't look quite right for a New Zealand fur seal, but whatever species it is, it's a fur seal, probably 1 or 2 year old, a small juvenile. It's very lean. You see very lean fur seals, more so in the sort of the subtropical species like the Guadalupe, and the Galapagos fur seal. But yeah, it's unusual for that part of the world. Poor little fella got lost.
If it was from South America and that area, that is quite a track, isn't it, to get there from Tonga?
Whichever one it is from, you know, even Galapagos, it's quite a way away. It would be the animal got carried on a current. It's probably gone the wrong way and got caught in the current and dragged all the way out there. Or it followed some tasty fish and then got lost. Who knows? It might snuck a long way from Guadalupe or South America, but the currents can move quite fast and take animals along. It's looking lean, but it's in not terrible health, what I can tell. When they're very lean, their ribs sort of show through the coat. It looked tired. Could have been very chill. I don't know. If there's a vet locally, it'd be good to get it checked out to see how it is and get a blood sample, to maybe some DNA to see which species it is. But it's definitely an unusual occurrence.
The people who found it in Tonga had never seen a seal before, and they posted on social media saying, "What is this?" So what? Why is it so unusual to see those kind of fur seals in that part of the world?
There's no breeding colonies in the region, largely because the water's too warm, and fur seals tend to generally breed in regions where the water is colder and more productive. So that's where you have them, you know, in the subpolar regions and the colder temperate regions. All that part of the world is full of islands, but it's all tropical islands, and so not a best place for them to be.
Is it likely that this guy was traveling by himself, or could there be others in Tongan waters, or how likely is that?
Hard to tell. I suspect it's probably one or maybe a couple more were just traveling, feeding, and got carried on some currents. Yeah, there could be others nearby who also got lost, but usually just a single.
And that there is Professor John Arnold from Deakin University speaking there to our reporter Natasha Emick.
Discover the stories that shape our region on Culture Compass. Travel across the Pacific with Afamasanga Sayuli Salamasina von Reiki as she traces the shift from oral traditions to online connections and explores the delicate balance between conservation and cultural practice across the islands. Culture Compass, a journey through resilience, revival and deep connection. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, all over the world, the welfare and humane treatment of animals remains the driving force for the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty, or RSPCA. In Papua New Guinea, where animal welfare resources are limited, the RSPCA faces a greater challenge in caring for wildlife and domestic pets. Aside from the common challenge of reducing the population of stray dogs and cats, the sale of wildlife in PNG is also a major concern. Just recently, an endemic tree-dwelling mammal, the kaskas, was rescued from the black market in Lae. Whenau Whanua spoke to RSPCA General Manager in PNG, Diane Davillas.
Recently, this creature, the kuskus, was rescued. First of all, what is a kuskus? Am I pronouncing it right?
No, it's pronounced kaskas, and it's an indigenous native animal to Papua New Guinea. It's like a koala bear and similar to a sloth. Very fuzzy, and it's a nocturnal animal. It carries its joeys in its pouch. It lives in trees, and it has a long tail that they use to grip onto branches. It's not a threatened, and it's not an endangered animal in PNG, but we discourage the sale of native animals, you know, being RSPCA.
Could you describe the rescue of this particular creature?
Yes, it was actually an acquaintance of mine in Lae. He noticed that there was someone standing outside the yacht club in Lae wanting to sell this animal. It's a female kaskas with a little joey, and it was very tame. So he confiscated the animal. They were wanting to sell it for 800 kina. And got the ball rolling. They took the kaskas to the Tree Kangaroo Preservation Society in Lae, who said that the kaskas was too tame to actually be released back into the wild. We had our veterinarian check it out. We transferred it to the Nature Park, which is our facility in Port Moresby. It's nothing to do with us, but they have all the native animals, tree kangaroos, kaskas, wallabies, cassowaries and whatnot. So they rehome any animal that cannot be rehabilitated into the wild.
How big of this is a problem, the trading of wildlife?
It is quite a big problem. A lot of the animals get eaten. A lot of the animals get used for traditional headdresses. So I know Nature Park have introduced a new program where they're selling artificial feathers people can buy. Because if you've had a look at any of the Papua New Guinean traditional outfits, it's a lot of animal skins and feathers. And, one day the animals are going to become endangered and there'll be nothing left for future generations.
How much of a threat is that?
Well, we don't actually have any official numbers because PNG is such a diverse country, and I mean, Port Moresby is not accessible to any of the other provinces except by plane because of the mountainous terrain. So we don't really know the full extent, but we do know that if the ongoing practice of slaughtering native animals continues, we are going to run into trouble down the line.
Could you tell us about the laws and regulations regarding wildlife?
Well, it's actually very outdated. The Animal Act goes back to 1952 and it seriously needs to be looked at. There is actually no law against the selling of animals, but in National Capital District, where Port Moresby is based, the NCDC, which is the municipality, the council, they prohibit the sale of native animals within NCDC. So we are actually through the biosecurity division of the government, we are empowered to actually confiscate any animals in NCDC that are being sold. So we're a not-for-profit organization. We run the only veterinary clinic in the country. We have two vets and six vet nurses that have been trained on site. We see private patients, clients, but we also do community outreaches when we fundraised. This year, we had two delegations from Vet Beyond Borders come visit us, and we managed to go out into seven different villages, and we de-sexed 694 cats and dogs for free.
That's one of the primary functions of RSPCA agencies, yes, across the region, to de-sex animals, particularly, yes, dogs and cats. How big of that is a problem in PNG, stray dogs and stray cats?
Oh, big problem. Very, very big problem. The problem here is that even a lot of owned dogs are free roaming. So people generally, well, a lot of people don't keep their dogs behind a closed gate. So even owned animals roam around the streets and contribute towards the stray dog population. We often treat car accidents, dogs and cats with broken bones or that have fallen from a height, sometimes have to amputate. We obviously do de-sexing operations, sometimes cesarean sections when a dog or cat is in trouble with birth. We had a young dog that was brought in by a couple. He had no hair. He was an absolute skin and bone and tail between his legs, and this couple decided they were going to rescue him. And he made full recovery. He had mange, so he had no hair. So he was treated here, and after fattening him up and de-sexing him and vaccinating, he eventually went home, and he's the most beautiful dog now. You'd never have thought that he came from that. Also, one of the most horrible parts of this job is to seeing the animal abuse. Treat your pet like you would treat your child. If you're kind to animals, you'll be kind to humans.
And that was Diane de Villiers, RSPCA General Manager in PNG. Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at some of our main stories. Tonga's Prime Minister celebrates the injection of fresh blood into his cabinet after Sivoki Lavemau has been appointed Finance Minister, making her one of the youngest ministers in the kingdom's history.
No, I think it's a great opportunity for us to celebrate those who have been appointed from outside, especially a very young and capable woman at the helm of finance.
And of course, Fiji's High Court delivers a damning decision on the Commission of Inquiry into the head of the country's anti-corruption watchdog. And the rare appearance of a seal in the tropical waters of Tonga has created a buzz on social media. Find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. So stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Till next time, o tō awhātu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.